hello, friends, listeners, and everyone else tuning in from around the world today. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and this is Red Ice Radio. We are headquartered out of the west coast of Sweden. That's up in Scandinavia, if you're confused about that. We cover tons of different topics, and our priority, if you will, is to provide you with information and perspectives. Sometimes contradictory, very intentionally so that we get a chance to challenge what we think we know and continue to reevaluate as a means to coming to accurate conclusions and authenticity, or call it truth, if you will. And if you want to hear more radio on many other topics that we find to be among the most important and interesting, I can recommend checking out our websites, redicecreations.com, that's R-E-D-I-C-E, redicecreations.com, and redicemembers.com. Today we have Jesse Ventura with us. He's the former independent governor of Minnesota. He's also a former U.S. Navy frogman, professional wrestler, actor, visiting fellow at Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and a New York Times best-selling author. He was also the host and executive producer for True TV's Conspiracy Theory. Jesse is with us today to discuss his new book, They Killed Our President, 63 Reasons to Believe There Was a Conspiracy to Assassinate JFK. And later in the hour, we'll discuss current politics, including American foreign policy, political parties, war, gun control, and one world government. Stay with us for much more. Well, hi, Jesse. Welcome to Red Ice Radio. Thank you for coming on with us. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Excellent. Now, I think most of our listeners are familiar with your background in some capacity and have some, you know, things, some ideas about some of the stuff you've done in the past with your TV show here most recently, of course. But JFK, you know, obviously as important as ever to demonstrate the high stakes game of politics and what kind of environment government has turned into and been in the last 50 years now. But it's a half a century ago JFK was assassinated, Jesse. Why is this still important to you, and why did you want to write a book about it?
Well, I think that it's important because it truly, his assassination changed the world. I believe very strongly that had John F. Kennedy lived, the world would be a far different place today than what it turned out to be. I was 12 years old when the president was murdered, and you know, by all indications of the research I've done and the documentation that's out there, clearly Kennedy was taking the country on a road to peace, which there were powerful forces that did not want that. Kennedy wouldn't go to war in Cuba at the Bay of Pigs. He had ordered the first advisors out of Vietnam and had stated that we'd be out of Vietnam completely by 65. And he also was communicating with Nikita Khrushchev, and that they were both agreeing that they should end the Cold War. And now when you look at that situation of what would the world be like today had there been no Vietnam War and had the Cold War, say, ended in the 60s rather than in the 80s, what type of world would we be living in today? And I think it would be a far more peaceful, or a world directed far more towards peace, than today's version of what you see, the world directed more towards war, top to bottom.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Now, in this environment, do you think that the same could be said about the Soviets, let's say? I mean, is it possible that at that time, if you were to give them an inch, they would have taken your whole arm?
Gone along?
Yeah. What do you
think?
Well,
there were forces there that didn't want it to happen either.
Exactly.
I mean, the great book on that is called JFK and the Unspeakable, and it's written by an author named Douglas, who is actually a Vatican archivist. He writes for the Vatican and goes into Vatican history, and he found the documents in the Vatican after the Cuban Missile Crisis that Kennedy and Khrushchev were back-channel communicating with each other, and that unbeknownst to both of their countries, and if you look at the end results, both men had visions for peace. I view Nikita Khrushchev today as a hero, because he had a vision of peace, and he backed down two times on the brink of what could have been nuclear war. It was Khrushchev who did the initial blink and backed down. And look at the end results. Pope John, who was the intermediary, died of cancer. JFK was murdered, and Nikita Khrushchev was removed from power, and thus we had the Cold War for another 25 years.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Now, a little bit later here, we want to get into who is behind the plot and everything else. But if we just, for a moment, look at Oswald a little bit here, you know, the book depository, the shots, the magic bullet, it's, I mean, in my view, in a way, it's all been pretty much discredited. But maybe we can just talk a little bit about who Oswald actually, you know, was and who he was working for.
Well, again, Oswald, to me, by all indication, clearly was a low-level intelligence agent for the country. There's witnesses to that fact that we point out in the book who met Oswald, and they happened to be in that business and knew that he was also. You also have people like Judith Very Baker, who worked with Oswald in New Orleans and worked both with him at the O'Reilly Coffee Company, which was a front job for both of them. And in fact, Judith's main part of her job was to make sure Lee's time card got punched in and out at the proper time every day. And she initialed all those and she kept them. So, you know, her evidence is impeccable. And she's also the person who told me that Lee Oswald and Jack Ruby knew each other very well because she went to dinner with both of them on multiple occasions. And at one time, Ruby actually gave her $50 because she was short of money at the time. And, you know, when you've got things like that in Oswald's background, the fact that when he was in the military, he was a radar technician at a highly secretive base in Japan where the U-2 spy planes operated out of, the fact that he was given training in a foreign language lets me know as a former veteran that he obviously worked in some type of intelligence while he was in the military because he wasn't infantry, and that you also tie in. He wasn't a particular good shot. If he was a good shot, he would have been 0300 infantry. Instead, he was a radar technician. He probably never hardly carried a weapon the entire time he was in the military,
yeah,
other than boot camp. And yet they have us believe that he could outshoot the top Marine Corps sniper in history, who they recreated the shots for and who could not duplicate them. I'm speaking, of course, of Carlos Hathcock, a legendary person in the Marines, the former chief instructor at Quantico, the Marine Sniper School. And he also outshot me. You know, and I'm a pretty fair shot, and I have a military background, and I attempted to recreate the shots, and it was laughable. The weapon itself is so terrible, and then you come to learn that the telescopic sight on the weapon, when they actually had it, wasn't sighted in. It required two metal shins to be added to get it on sight. Any hunter, anybody that's ever hunted with a weapon in their life will tell you the first thing you do is sight the weapon in. You can't hit anything if the sights are off.
Yeah.
And this weapon, the sights were off.
It's an amazing feat, you know, if you pull it off. But the fact is, he didn't, I think. We could say that to a certain degree. But where did you look then in terms of you know, alternatives for explaining what actually happened?
Well, the main thing, you know, it's very difficult to pick out and name who did it. You know, you always, when I
sure.
do these interviews, people right away, well, who did it, who
right.
did it, who did it?
Right.
And after 50 years and the cover-up that's gone on, it's very difficult to pinpoint who did it. There's a lot of good suspects out there. No one having ever been put under oath and a trial never having happened. But the one thing I think my book will clearly show people is that who didn't do it. And that was Lee Oswald. And I think it's high time he have his name cleared. Lee Oswald was never convicted, ever. They can't put the gun in his hand. None of that stuff. And you know, how can you convict someone when you can't put the weapon in their hand of murder?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really what my book tries to show. It gives you 64. We have to remember the threshold of murder is very high. It's called Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. And I think when anyone reads my book, they will clearly see that any lawyer could have gotten Oswald acquitted because there was so much that was not beyond a reasonable doubt. In fact, there was so much that gave reasonable doubt, a tremendous amount of reasonable doubt, that virtually, I think, anyone that believes that it has to be insane to think Oswald could have been convicted.
It's very interesting here that Jack Ruby comes along and shoots Oswald before anything practically can be found out about him. But what's the relationship there then? I mean, you said they knew each other and there's... But why did Jack do this?
Only Jack knows. So obviously why Jack did it was to silence Oswald. They couldn't have a trial.
Sure, yeah. Yep.
That was the sole reason he did it. And one of the things that's interesting personally for me, my mother, for some reason, she passed away in 1995, for some reason she kept all the Minneapolis papers from that weekend, and my son and I found them in a trunk. And we were going through them. This was a number of years ago. My son was probably 14 or 15 then, so it's nearly 20 years ago now. And we're going through these Minneapolis papers, and we came to the Monday morning paper. Now, this is the Minneapolis early edition Monday morning, which it's pre-computer. So that means this had to go out no later than late afternoon Sunday. No later than that.
Yeah.
Which essentially is right after Oswald was killed. Here's a subheadline in the Minneapolis Monday morning paper down in the bottom of the front page. Dallas police declare case closed.
Hmm.
Now, my son, who was 14 at the time, I think, looked at me, and you know what his 14-year-old response was?
Nope.
He said, gee, Dad, they spend more time on a domestic.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll never forget it when he said that to me, and all I could do was look at him and go, son, you're right.
Yeah.
What else could I say to this 14-year-old boy? Now, if he could see that, how is it that all the adults on this planet can't see it?
Well, they have the best of the best working on the case. That's why it happened so quick, right?
I don't know. But I mean, how can you possibly, you have an interview to witness, the alleged guy you think did it is now murdered in your custody. I mean, Lee Harvey Oswald should have been the safest man on the earth on Sunday.
Yeah, that's right.
How could there be 70 police officers in that building and someone was able to walk right up to him and dead shoot him right in the heart?
Unbelievable. Yeah, it is. It's really...
And they want us to believe... And yet the Warren Commission, through all their volumes, all those, how many, 26 volumes, never once criticized the police work.
Yep.
Well, how can that be? They were supposed to look at the whole thing that happened and give us a complete report. How could they not criticize, in some manner, the police work that was done that weekend?
Yeah, it's pretty astonishing. There's just so much with the official commissions that come out when these events, when these kinds of events happen, and so much omissions are allowed to pass through the filter, if you will. Let's talk a little bit about CIA's Operation 40, the hit squad, because that's a fascinating aspect that you go into in the book as well.
Well, this was going on during the time, of course, when the unholy alliance between the CIA and the American Mafia of organized crime had decided to team up, because apparently our government thought organized crime was better than Castro. And that's what they were attempting to do. All these operations were designed to either overthrow Cuba or assassinate Fidel Castro and see a new regime come to the country of Cuba, which I find so amazing that that's any of our business. I mean, they're their own sovereign nation, and shouldn't they have the right to determine their own destiny? But that aside, and what was happening was these operational forces were being run out of Washington via the southern part of Florida, with many Cuban nationals and all that involved who had been displaced by Castro. And they were actively involved in attempting to assassinate Castro, which I might add, wouldn't that be called terrorism today?
Yeah, you'd think so.
You know, I would think that that would fall under the definition of what we're being told is terrorism today. And here was a clear example of the United States practicing terrorism on Cuba. You know, that was one of the reasons I got banned from Fox TV. Because I made a statement on there once that I said, why should we be surprised that we'd be attacked by terrorists when we've been practicing terrorism for 50 years? We've just simply called it foreign policy.
Yeah, that's right.
And the guy on Fox News got all indignant and told me to give him an example of the United States practicing terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'll give you a great one. How about Cuba? You know, we've burned ships, we've blown up ships in their harbor, we've attempted to destroy their cane field, we've tried to destroy their economy, we've attempted assassinations on their leaders multiple times, and on top of that, there's this character, Orlando Bosch. Are you familiar with him?
No, I've heard his name, but not too much, yeah.
Well, he's a guy who blew up a Cuban airliner with a bomb and was pardoned by George Bush Sr.
Ah, okay.
Now, isn't blowing up a plane an act of terrorism?
You'd think so, yeah.
I guess it's not, though, when it comes from our side.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it's called, like I said, foreign policy.
Well, it's the same in with Iran and the revolution down there, and it goes on and on, obviously, and so many people have pointed this out, that there's a reason today why there's so much eyes on the United States. And even if the terrorism that we do see out there in the world is real, which many people have questioned as well, then it's at this stage certainly understandable, is it not?
Well, that's what I've always maintained. If we're going to look at this, quote, war on terror, I think we need to take the question to the point of, if these people truly are out to get our freedom, like we're being told, we need to ask and answer the question, why? What have we done?
Yeah.
What have we done that's incurred the wrath of these people to this level that they're willing to do this? And no one seems to want to go there. No one seems to want to ask that pertinent question. And I think it must be asked and answered so that we can truly understand the scope of whatever it is this terrorism we're fighting is all about.
Is the force domestic, do you think, within the from the question of the United States of the terrorism, if you will, is this a, do you see this as a long running operation overall?
Well, I view it as the part that troubles me the most is I'm 62 years old now, and I was born in 1951, post World War II. And as I look back on my life of 60 years as a patriotic citizen of the United States, every war in my lifetime, I have yet to figure out why we fought it.
Yeah.
Every one of them. And then when I look at the end results, I'm puzzled even more as to why we fought this. And that's what troubles me so greatly. And that's what I believe now the war on terror is. It's the fact that we seem to be driven that we have to be at perennial war all the time. That apparently we have an economy that's driven by war, and that it's war is required because we have such a huge military budget that we create. I mean, I was astounded to learn how the United States spends more on defense spending than the top 26 nations in the world combined,
yeah.
25 of which are supposed to be our allies.
That's right.
And I sit and go, why? What? How many times can we blow up the earth? And how many times? And to me, it came to me, and I realized that the spending is really a jobs program. They've got it spread out through the entire United States and every state, so that if you do cut back on military spending, you're going to see people in unemployment lines because they're going to lose their jobs unless somehow we can switch the focus to something else. And get just as creative with, say, alternative energy or something of that nature.
Well, exactly. It's a good point. I think that there will be a number of markets and industries, if you will, that will pop up in its place. But the way I see it, Jesse, anyway, is that I do see a bigger conspiracy here, if you will, an attempt to also, at the same time as they're using America, they're trying to break it down, build up a kind of an international hatred, if you will, against the USA. I don't know. Do you think I'm going too far?
No, I'm not surprised because I live outside the country now for 4 to 5 months a year. I live down in Mexico, and you get a different perspective when you get outside the United States and view it from the outside looking in as opposed to the inside looking out. And I wish every citizen had the opportunity that I have to be able to do that because I think they might take a different viewpoint. I mean, I want the United States to be the beacon of hope. I want what it used to be, or allegedly used to be, all countries throughout the world used to look to the United States with admiration and go, you know what, there's a democracy government working. Well, I can't say that today, and when I'm outside the country now, I don't see people viewing the United States as a beacon of hope anymore. I see them viewing the United States in fear that they'll incur our wrath in some way.
Yeah.
And that God knows what'll happen when that happens. And I personally don't want, that breaks my heart, being a loyal born American, to have my country, whenever I come back to my country now, I drive, right? And it's like entering East Berlin. The only thing missing at our border are the tanks, and I'm sure they're on the way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was a republic founded, on the principle of the free market catering towards the individual. And let's not forget, people from feudal Europe, they fled to get away from their governments over there because it was a tyranny, and other parts of the world as well. And that's why people, came to America. And is there any chance to go back to that state?
Oh, there is. I've stated unequivocally that the answer truly is as simple as the nose on your face, but it will be as difficult as climbing Mount Everest, and it'll be painful because you'll get punished for it. Anytime you attempt to change the direction of government, who's ever in power with that alternative direction will punish you, and you're going to have to feel some pain in being able to attempt to be successful. And here's the solution. The solution is to abolish political parties here. Stop voting for Democrats and Republicans. And you notice I include them together because there truly is not a difference. Yeah. They're both paid off in their system that they've created of bribery. And the bribery holds all the way true now to even foreign policy. When we want a country to get along with us, how do we get them to do that? We bribe them. We pay them money to do that. Case in point, it just happened. They had the shutdown of the government, and they were fearing that they weren't going to lift the debt ceiling, correct?
Yeah.
So they did lift the debt ceiling, which they had to do to keep our credit going. What's the first thing they did when they lifted the debt ceiling? They gave Pakistan, I don't know how many billions of dollars of foreign aid. So in other words, Pakistan gets the money and it goes on our credit card.
Yeah, yeah.
We have to pay for it. Excuse me. I will tell you this. If I became president of the United States, the first thing that would be abolished would be foreign aid.
Yeah. You guys got to get your, you got to get back up on your feet here because
When you're broke, how can you give other people money?
Well, you can't. And then, then that system that had been in place for that long time, America built up a great, wealth on its free market and everything else. So it became into a position where it actually could help other nations. But now it's down on its knees. It can't help anyone else. But yet it continues to give away. So the whole engine is going to be shut down, if you know what I mean.
Oh, I follow it completely, and I don't understand why people don't see this, and understand what's going on here. But then in a way, I look at the bigger picture, and maybe that's what it is. There's always this talk about a one-world government.
Oh, yeah.
We've all heard about this.
Yeah.
Maybe it's inevitable. Maybe it's evolution, because I do believe in evolution. And maybe it's inevitable that we will reach that state. I just didn't think I'd see it at all in my lifetime, and I may see it sooner rather than later. But you know what the one positive thing I've determined would be good about one world government?
No.
Can't think of anything, huh?
Well, of course there are a couple of things in terms of...
Well, here's the biggest thing, but would it be? If you had one world government, then there wouldn't be war anymore, would there?
Well, that's not necessarily true because we still
But you'd like to believe that, though.
Yeah, sure.
If there was only one set of who was in charge of the entire planet, well, then we shouldn't go to war anymore, should we?
Well, but there are civil war and there are gang war and there are all kinds of different wars.
I understand all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Please follow what I'm saying.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm simply saying hypothetically, with a one world government, that should eliminate war.
Well, see, I think that's the excuse when the League of Nations were set up after the Second World War or slightly, around that era period. This was the incentive at the time that we can't do this anymore. We have to start creating a world government. And that's when a lot of these people have come aboard on the bandwagon and said, yeah, absolutely, that's the way to go. But I think that that's also been the excuse, Jesse, to create it.
I agree fully with you. You get no argument from me on any of that. And is it good? I don't know. That's in the words of Star Trek, we're going to where no one else has been before. So I don't know. You know, it's a roll of the dice. You know, could it be good? Yeah, I was just making the point that on the perfect side of it, you would think that there would never be war again then. But we all know what is and what will be can be two different things.
And then it's all about, yeah, exactly. And then it's all about who is in charge of that system.
Then you got to make sure who's ever in charge is benevolent. Like I've always stated, you know what the greatest government is, don't you? Benevolent dictator.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, you're right.
But the key is you must be benevolent. You got to have term limits.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, again, that's the most important point, you know?
Well, as a benevolent dictator, then if you needed a bridge, you just order it.
That's right.
You don't have to bother with all this other nonsense, but the key is how do you ensure that the dictator will be benevolent and loved?
You can't. Even when you've built an infrastructure of world government in place, it might be great for a couple of years or 10 or 20 or whatever, but then the next day someone comes along to take over this big machine
which is
centralized.
Which is precisely the point of John F. Kennedy, and what people need to get out of his murder is this.
Mm-hmm.
Governments are made up of people.
Yes, exactly.
Evil people can become in charge. Evil people can get into government, and they can become powerful. And I always, of course, use the Germans as the example. You know, go talk to the German people in the 30s.
Or the Soviets.
Tell you how an evil people could get control of the government and become powerful. People need to remember that, and the United States can fall victim to the very same thing. That evil people can become in charge and can lead us down the wrong road. And ultimately, it's our responsibility to be vigilant and ensure that evil people don't become in charge.
Absolutely. As the Soviets, conservatively, 60 million people perished in the gulag systems and everything else, shot. You know, this is human history, unfortunately. This is, as you say, evil people will always use the structure that's in place to take control over a greater and greater system. And that's why I am, you know, ideologically opposed to a centralized government, because those people will not go away. They will ascend within that system, and then we have the worst scenario imaginable.
I agree with you. I agree with you. I am not for it either, and unless they make me in charge.
Well, again, then with that, back to that
point,
Jesse, you know.
Let me state this. I'm kind of offended. You know what I'm offended about?
No, no.
Well, I won governor. How come I didn't get invited to the Bilderbergs? I mean, I'm kind of offended over that. I mean, I thought, gee, I became a governor. Wouldn't I get at least one trip to the Bilderbergs and be able to sit in and see what goes on there?
Does every governor?
Huh?
Does every governor?
No, but, you know, I thought maybe, is it because I'm the independent that I didn't invite?
You were not ruthless enough, Jesse.
No, I think it's more that I'd come out and squeal on them.
Yeah, I think so too. That's probably the case. That's probably the case.
I'm too much for honesty, and I'd come out and tell everybody what they talked about.
Can't have anybody spill the beans like that, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. So what? You're running for president too, by the way, aren't you?
No, I am not.
You're not. That's a joke.
No.
Okay.
I made a statement because I haven't decided, but I just simply made the statement that 2016 would be the opportune time.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact, number one, and I have experience being not part of the two parties and winning twice, you have to do it when there's not an incumbent.
Right.
It makes it easier. And 2016, there will be no incumbent. Number two, it's almost like destiny. They're setting the table for me. I mean, their behavior these last couple of years has been so horrible. They've now alienated 90% of the country, hates the Congress. Well, I would run, and if I did run, I'll tell you exactly the one issue I would run on, and it would basically be only one issue. I would give the American people the opportunity to vote and elect the first president since George Washington, the father of the country, who doesn't belong to a political party. And I truly believe with public sentiment like it is today, I could win on that issue alone if I was given a fair chance and was allowed to be in the debates.
Yeah, yeah. And will that happen?
Well, of course it's not going to. The two parties control the debates.
Yeah.
You haven't heard a third voice in a debate for 20 years.
No, no.
Yeah, and the last time you did, he got 20% of the vote. They don't dare let that happen. You know, I mean, I'm of the belief if I can debate them, I can beat them because they've got all the baggage.
Yeah, and I mean, even if we think about that, let's say a third party is brought in or whatever.
I don't want a third party.
Well, exactly.
Well, because I don't advocate for a third party anymore. Here's why.
Yeah.
They've built a system completely based on bribery. It's completely corrupt, and any third party will have to corrupt itself in which to compete.
Exactly.
So therefore, I stand for the abolishment of political parties. Abolish them. Turn them into political action committees. They could still endorse candidates, and the best way to do it, take their names off the ballot box. Why do we have political parties' name on an election ballot? Put just the candidate's name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That would be huge.
Yeah.
Just to accomplish that. And that, I could add, could be done locally.
Right. Well, and even with the, we know there's always security risk with everything, but the fact is that even utilizing, you know, the internet and everything else for more smaller issues these days, I don't see why that shouldn't be an issue that more and more people could get involved in even the minor decisions that are made in terms of where government is supposed to go, you know. But we're very much stuck in a system that's, you know, invented, you know, a couple of hundred years ago here.
Well, you're stuck in a system that initially was invented a couple hundred years ago and was terrific. But it was up to us as citizens to keep our vigilance and maintain it.
Yeah.
And we haven't done that. We've allowed these two political parties to become the power brokers. See, the problem is decisions are made for their party first, not the country first.
That's right.
That was clearly shown when they're willing to shut the government down on behalf of their own party interest. In other words, their party interest was more important than the interest of the country. They would jeopardize the security of the United States of America in which to promote their party interest, which clearly shows you that the party's number one, then it's the party's money people number two, and then we, the people, might be third, maybe. And I covered that in my previous book, The Democrips and the Republicans, No More Gangs in Government, where I demanded that we abolish these political parties.
Yeah. Well, it's the good old Hegelian dialectic. It's a very conscious political philosophy that you use to drive policy forward, where nothing really, you know, can be done outside of that paradigm. So I think it's very understandable why they've kept it in that way, you know?
Well, they're gangs. They're no different than street gangs.
That's
right. Identical. That's why I made the comparison. Your loyalty has to be to the gang first. Then it's how does the gang make its money, which is just like a street gang. And they're no different. Only thing is, like I tell people, they wear Brooks Brothers suits. That's what makes them different.
Yeah. Well, the question I think everyone is asking then at this point is basically if that's the structure that we're faced with, if you will. And I wouldn't say that there's really much that difference in other parts of the world. America is more, powerful in that way, and the system is more kind of rigid, if you will. But it's basically the same everywhere. But how can we go from that model of that is currently in place with the crooks that's there? And if you have someone who comes along and tries to change something, then there's the, you know, bullets for those people.
The answer is as simple as the nose on your face, but it'll be as difficult as climbing Mount Everest. Stop voting for them.
And what would happen, do you think, then? Would the system shut down?
We'd get a citizen government again. Stop voting for Democrats and Republicans.
Yep.
Vote for anyone else, but good luck. Good luck on accomplishing that. See, people are under an influence here that somehow, if they switch from Democrat to Republican or Republican to Democrat, that they're somehow changing the government. No, they're not. As long as you continue to vote for either of these two parties, you are going to get the same government because both sides are paid off by the same political lobbyists.
Yeah.
It's like betting on a sports game. If you bet on both teams, you don't lose, do you?
That's right.
And that's what they do.
Yeah.
And the point is, we have to quit electing the people that are paid off, which means the two political parties. And until we do that, you look at polls today, and what, 60% of the people or more claim to be independent?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then why are they voting for people of these two parties if they're independent?
Well, my question has always been, are they Or is the voting system so rigged now that even they're faking the votes themselves?
Well, we're running that is a danger, especially with these electronic voting machines they've implemented. I've covered that in my other conspiracy book.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're very dangerous. I always equate them to ATM machines. I tell people, would you go to an ATM machine, a cash machine, that didn't offer you a receipt? And people always go, absolutely not. I go, then why would you go to a voting machine that doesn't offer you a receipt? How, when you push the button, you have no way of knowing if that vote was registered for the candidate you chose.
Yeah.
Where with the standard paper ballot, where you have to fill in the little circle and they count them one at a time, sometimes things are best left the old way. And if you're not capable of doing that, you've been doing that since first grade. The first test you took in grade school required you to fill in the blank, darken in the circle. If you're incapable of doing that, then maybe you shouldn't be voting anyway.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Jesse, then. Let's say that you have no turnout in reference of voting here. Yeah, I think you'd never get 100% no participation, but you could get it fairly high. How high would that be before something would happen? And do you have any idea of if there's any happened in the past?
In order to get a large voter turnout, you need an alternative choice. I can tell you that from my running in Minnesota.
Okay, yeah.
When I ran in Minnesota, I was polling 10% at the primary, but because I was allowed in the debates, 7 weeks later, I was the governor. And one of the reasons I knew I was going to win was when the polling said that I was at 27% and that they were calling it a three-way race, and they predicted a 50% voter turnout because it was off year. It wasn't presidential, and generally not as many people choose to vote then. It turned out that it had a 60% voter turnout. I went from 27 to 37. So that additional 10% all came out and voted for me. And that was why they voted, because there was a third choice. Many people have given up voting because they know that it doesn't matter. You're going to get one or the other.
Yeah.
And so they don't bother. And it's like the late, great Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead said. He said, if you're made to pick the lesser of two evils, it still means you're picking evil.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's truth here. So you have to have a viable third choice or some alternative to the two that are there right now. If that happens, you will then see a massive higher voter turnout. Another case in point, when I was governor, there were only two independent governors in America, myself and Governor Angus King of Maine. And ironically, guess who the two states are that lead the United States in voter turnout every year? Per capita, Minnesota and Maine.
Oh, really? Huh.
Always. Mm-hmm. Take it to the bank.
Interesting.
Take it to the bank that the highest voter turnout for the amount of people will be in those two states, Minnesota and Maine. And ironically, we were the two states that had independent governors. And Angus just got elected after going back to the private sector for 6 years or whatever it was. He just got elected as the new independent senator from Maine.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a good point, too. Today you have these professional politicians. They're not just there for a little bit to represent, the country or, some of the interests. They're there permanently and stuck there. And that's another, fault with the system.
Well, that's because they get to create their own voting districts and there's no competition in them.
Exactly, yeah.
Over 90% of the congressional voting districts, they know who's going to win before the vote even happens. Because they make them, they jury-rig them that way, so they're all Republican or all Democrat. None of the districts are ever competitive.
Wow, yeah.
Isn't it amazing what Jesse Ventura knows, this old pro wrestler?
but you've looked at the system with open eyes, and you realize where it's going. This, as you said before, this is when you honestly look at it, you can figure it out.
I think it's more this. Professional wrestlers are a lot better educated than people give them credit for.
that could be.
It just happens we work in a show business endeavor where you play a character no different than an actor in Hollywood, only it's live theater.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
That's nice. All.
Yeah.
As I refer to it, it's ballet with violence.
What was it Eddie Murphy said in that movie when he was a petty thief and he get this epiphany, he realized, I got to go into politics to make the big money.
There you go.
I can't remember what it was called, but, you know, yeah, it's the same thing there, you know.
Absolutely.
So, how do you think, Jesse, if we look into the crystal ball a little bit here, how do you think America will develop? It's a difficult question, I know that, but with everything that's going on right now, and where do you think it will go here in the next few years?
I hate to be the negative optimist, but this is the first time in my life that I've looked at the United States of America and the future of it, and I'm not happy. It's the first time in my 60 years I don't see as much light at the end of the tunnel, that tomorrow may not be a better day.
Yeah.
And that bothers me tremendously, and the only people I can blame for that ultimately are we, the citizens, because we've allowed it to happen by not being vigilant, and our elected Democrats and Republicans who have done it to us.
That's right. Personal responsibility.
Yes.
So that's where the key is as well then, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If we don't start participating and becoming vigilant, which was required when our forefathers made this country, that was a requirement in order for it to survive. And we're not, just like when Ben Franklin made the statement, for those that will give up their liberty for security shall have and deserve neither.
That's right.
And we, since 9/11, we've given up our liberty for security. We're not listening to Benjamin Franklin.
So people are scared into submission, basically.
Yeah, by a government and a media that's working together to accomplish that, to make the people all frightened. I mean, people think there's a terrorist behind every tree.
That's right.
And I've told people, you have about as much chance of being hit by terrorism as you do to win the Powerball.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
You know, and so why are people being frightened into this? Well, to make them submissive and to make them lose their freedoms. The scary thing about that whole Boston Marathon thing, to me, it wasn't the bombing. It was the fact the military was loose on our streets.
Yeah, that's right.
That to me, was nothing more than a run-through for martial law.
That's right. A little test.
That's how I viewed it.
Yeah, I agree.
And I wasn't even in the country when it happened. I just viewed it over the internet with my co-writer Dick Russell, who brought it up so I could see it. And my initial reaction was, this is a run-through for martial law. This is a practice thing.
Yeah. But it's not going to be as easy in the U.S. as there is potentially in other countries with this.
People cheered in Boston.
Well, that's true, but I'm thinking as well.
They cheered. They wanted it done. They're saying, do it to me.
Yeah.
I'll tell you this. If the government ever tells me that I have to stay in my house, I will immediately walk up and walk down the middle of the street.
Right, yeah.
Because there is nothing in the Constitution, the United States Constitution, that gives the government the right to imprison me in my home.
Yeah, that's right.
They do not have that right to do that. And therefore, I will take my chances. If I do get killed out there, so be it. But I will never be told by my government to stay inside for my safety.
Yeah, and neither have they the right to go into your house and snoop on your activity, but they do that too. So,
well, they're not supposed to.
Yeah, but you guys are armed. That was my point. There are a lot of people in the U.S. that are aware of this, at least, and have they have that fighting spirit in them still.
Well, we have it until they destroy our Second Amendment, which they're working hard to do.
They certainly are. Oh, yeah.
You know, that's the Democrats' job, to disarm us, like Bill Maher and them.
Yeah, that's right.
Their job is to get on TV and tell us the government will keep us safe, turn in your weapons. My biggest argument to that philosophy is this. I was personally in the Philippines the day that Ferdinand Marcos declared martial law and became a dictator.
Oh, yeah, you were there?
I was there.
Huh.
You know what his first order as dictator was?
Take all the guns.
He gave the people, I think, 10 to 14 days to turn in all their guns, or it was the death penalty.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, I would ask anybody, why would that be the first thing a dictator would do?
To keep himself safe.
Exactly. So that he can be just what he is, a dictator.
Yep.
So so for all these people, and people fail to realize this, in the last century, there's been about 5 to 6 genocides committed in the world, right? Massive genocides where government have slaughtered their people.
Yeah.
Every place that's been done has been a place that exercises strict gun control because the people had no way to stand up.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. And I just don't see the people who don't understand that point. They always go for the emotional point that, okay, if you're for guns, you're for the murdering of children. Like, that's the best argument they have kind of thing, which is ridiculous, obviously.
Exactly.
But that's what you get, you know, back when you talk about, no, it's actually with those guns that you can defend those children. Otherwise, you know.
Do you want to hear my argument on the children thing?
Sure, yeah, please.
Here's my argument. What do we value more, our children or our money?
Our children.
No, because we have armed guards at the bank. We have nothing at school.
Yeah, see, it's a good point.
No, I mean, think of that.
Yeah.
We any bank you walk into is going to have a guy there with a gun in a holster.
Yeah, yeah.
Somewhere in the bank. At our schools, nothing.
Yeah, it's true.
So we obviously want our money protected more.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, the proof is in what you do, not what you say.
Exactly. Absolutely. You're right. So that's the reasoning behind that. I mean, it's like, because no matter how many rules and laws you set up, that's the very idea of a criminal. They don't follow those rules and laws. So what does
exactly.
it matter? You know? Yeah.
Exactly. But see, that's all part of the picture to disarm us and to get us to lose. I think there's an asserted effort going on to destroy the middle class in America so that they can put us under one currency like they did Europe. Here it'll be Canada, the U.S., and Mexico.
Yeah.
And the only way that can happen is to make Mexico and America have the same economy.
That's right. That's right. Well, that's where it's heading, you know, with the North American Union.
Yeah.
And we have it in the Eurozone already. And look at how that's going. It's just a tremendous mess with the rules and the laws. And it's just, I've never seen any spectacle like that in many years.
You know? Well, I haven't lived in Europe, so I'm not going to comment on it because right. I haven't had the opportunity to live under it or see what it's doing. But in what you've just said and what I believe, I don't think it's a good idea.
No, it is not. It's complete, well, look at the countries that are being, you know, forced into certain positions like Greece now and Cyprus, and with the austerity measures and everything else that's being, you know, understandably to a certain degree imposed on them on the other European countries that are forced to pay the bill, you know, if you will, for some of these countries. So it's just not a good idea. You need, you know, smaller pockets of self autonomous, you know, communities.
And some sovereignty. If you
will. Yeah, exactly.
Although I am for taking the borders down.
Well, you should be able to travel freely across
exactly.
the globe.
To me, we're all people of this planet. We shouldn't have to have paperwork to go anywhere.
I agree with that, you know. And then it's true. And then the difficult question becomes, of course, okay, but where do you draw the line in terms of, you know, should people be able to move wherever they want to? And you know, to a certain degree, I think so. But it's I don't know. It's There are a lot of questions here that we need to figure out as we go forward, because I think that just bringing in a world government is not going to solve any of these issues. They're still going to remain, you know. So
bringing in a world government means just another layer of government.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And we got enough layers of that.
Well, should the U.S. return to its minarchist kind of small government, position?
Well, I follow the teachings. Are you familiar with Major General Smedley Butler?
Again, heard the name, but not too familiar, no.
Well, he wrote a book, the most anti-war book that's ever been written, called War is a Racket.
Oh, okay, yeah, I'm familiar with that, yeah, sure.
And no one can question General Butler's patriotism, because he won not one, but 2 Congressional Medals of Honor.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book that's telling the world that war is indeed a racket, and he wrote that book nearly 80 to 90 years ago, and it so applies to today, you can't believe it.
Yeah.
And he said that we should pass a constitutional amendment that says the U.S. military cannot go over 500 miles from our shore.
Well, they should be in your country to protect the country. That's the idea,
exactly.
Right? Yeah.
And I would adhere to those teachings, and I would attempt to do that, to keep the United States military within 500 miles of our border.
So let me ask you this, because we could do a historical example here, or a comparison, I guess, when the Labour Party got in 1945 in the UK, and the end of the imperialist Britain kind of ended at that point. There was a lot of people with good intentions that wanted to end, you know, the colonies that they had, basically. And one of the consequences of this is that they, if you will, pulled out way too quick out of some of these regions. And one of them was when the formation of India and Pakistan occurred. And I think over 1 million people died just in the relocation process that was involved in this alone. And let's say, is there a similar scenario now with the United States, who have military in all these different regions, that if they would just basically pull out of there overnight, that would also cause a lot of problems and issues? So is it that simple to just pull out?
So,
what do you think?
So the United States is the policeman?
Well, unfortunately, they've kind of set themselves in that position a little bit now, right?
I don't know. I'm asking you. So we're the police. If we pull out with these bases in 178 countries, the countries will immediately go into civil war?
Well, I don't think it will be that, black and white, perhaps. But certainly in certain regions, there will be, fighting.
So the United States is the one stopping wars from happening.
Well, that's what they want to. That's what they want you to think, right? But I'm saying,
I don't know. I'm trying to learn this from you.
Right.
This is new to me.
Okay.
That our military is out there, and because they're out there, they're stopping wars from happening.
Well, they're causing them, but I guess
we seem to be starting the wars.
Well, that's true. But just the idea there that once you've stirred the pot, if you know what I mean, and once you're in the region, then
well,
my point is there.
Any type of drastic change, there's going to be some pain felt.
That's right. That's true. You know.
Then you have to look at the big picture down the road, and is it worth it or not?
Yeah, the problem is they shouldn't have done it to begin with, of course. That's my main
exactly,
point.
Exactly, I agree, because colonization's a thing of the past, and it shouldn't have been done in the first place, but it was, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And now we have to reverse it all, and if there's some pain to reverse it, I think that's a pain that, unfortunately, we have to feel.
Yeah, I think you're right. Unfortunately, that's a consequence of some of this behavior, if you will, but... what are some of the other points here, Jesse, before we begin to wrap things up here for this time? If there's anything more, maybe perhaps from the book, or any other thoughts that you have that you would like to just get out there before we talk about the websites and such?
Again, I urge people to that it's time that we reclaim our own history. I hate to use that terminology because Bugliosi used it and said Oswald did it. But we need to have the history come clean for a change. I mean, Oliver North's series on the U.S. history that we're not reading about, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's unbelievably good. And we need to start lifting away this plastic house we've built, because if it's built upon lies, then the foundation is no good to begin with.
Yeah.
And we need to clear those up so that history is true. I think that we start with the case and the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald has children. Probably today he may even have grandchildren. And he's been demonized as being this horrific murderer that killed our most beloved president in modern times. And if that's not true, I think that we need to work to ensure that that's changed.
Definitely. And is there any indication that any of this will come to a resolution? Will we come closer to not solving the case, but will this be more officially recognized, do you think?
I would hope so. It was interesting because at least now when you go to some places, they at least say, he was only charged with the crime. He was never convicted. It was like I did Fox Business the other day with Tom Sullivan. And the lead-in on my book, the lead-in, they introduced Oswald as convicted killer Lee Harvey Oswald. And as soon as it came out to us, I said, Tom, there you go. You people are calling him a convicted killer when he was convicted of nothing. He never had a day in court. So without a day in court, no one can be convicted or thought of doing anything. Lee Oswald needs his name cleared because he never had a day in court.
Yeah, it's a very good point.
And you are innocent. You are innocent until proven guilty. In the case of Lee Oswald, he has been deemed guilty and forced to prove he's innocent. And that's wrong in this country. Because in this country, you're innocent until they prove you guilty, and they have never, ever proved that Lee Harvey Oswald was guilty of murdering John Kennedy, and we need to change history to so record that.
Indeed, indeed. Now, there's, of course, a lot more in the book than what we talked about here today. We've got into some of the other tangents, which is great, of course, but for everyone who wants to kind of dive into this, the book is They Killed Our President, 63 Reasons to Believe That There Was a Conspiracy to Assassinate JFK. And there's three different sections with a lot of the evidence, of course, laid out in black and white in terms of what is known about the case and, of course, a lot of the follow-up questions to that. But, Jesse, where would people go to pick up a copy of the book?
Well, they can get the book in any bookstore, Amazon.com. It's out there all over. And I'm proud on Amazon. The book is getting 5 stars, unbelievably, and the worst is 4.5. And so people that are getting the book are loving the book. It's an easy read. You can read a few chapters and then pick it up a day later and pick up right where you left off, because each chapter in its own is separate. And it builds a chronological up to the, you know, the belief that you're going to see clearly that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone, if he acted at all. And that's really what I set out to do, because telling you who killed him today is extremely difficult, because it's a crime that took place 50 years ago. But convicting someone who never was convicted or had their day in court is likewise equally as wrong.
Yeah, indeed, it's an open question to this point to this day, and we still haven't managed to get closer to it in that regard. And it's it's a good outline. But what are some of the website and Facebook pages and such where people can find out more about you and your work, Jesse?
Oh, geez, I don't know. You're asking me the hardest question of all, because I don't do them damn computers. People do them for me.
All right, okay.
Well, I'm honest to a fault. And no, there's websites. If you got them in front of you, you can rattle them off. But they can go to Jesse Ventura, where I forget what all of them are, but they're out there. The computer people will know.
Well, I have a couple here I can give out. JesseVentura.net, I believe, if that's an official page, that is. But then you have the Facebook page that you give out, and that you give that out in the book as well. It's simply facebook.com/official. Jesse Ventura. And we'll have all the links up related to this on our page as well,
yep,
Jesse. So.
Very good. Yeah, and the great thing about the book is we list where you can go on the internet when we give you a piece of evidence that you have accessibility to. You can go right on the internet and view and see that evidence yourself and make your own decision.
Excellent. Well, thank you for coming on the program, Jesse. Keep up the good work and keep asking those questions, all right?
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it very much, and have a great day, and we'll do it again sometime.
All right, everybody, there you go. Thank you for listening and spending some of your time with us. You know, I remember when our Prime Minister, Olof Palme, here in Sweden, got shot back in 1986. And that case has so many parallels to the JFK assassination. There might even be some relation to the Responsible People Operation 40, the usual suspects, if you will. We have some great shows in our archives on this topic, and of course more on the JFK assassination. So if you want to hear more and check out our TV shows, videos, and busy news section, you can look at redicecreations.com for much more. We spare you from commercial interruptions, and we have an archive full of programs going back to 2006 on all kinds of topics. Redicemembers.com is where you'll find the full archives. Next up on the program, we have Andreas Bachmeier from Switzerland on children that are healthier unvaccinated. He's been part of one of the only surveys that's been done on children that has not gotten vaccines, and there is some interesting data in that show. Judy Byington on 22 Faces. That's about the ritual abuse of mind control victim Jenny Hill. We also have Cliff High, Louise Proud, John Whitehead, Anthony Peake, and many, many more following that. All right, we'll be back in just a few days. My thanks to the team, and I hope you have a great weekend. We'll speak to you in just a few then. Take care, and stay cool.